Blog Talk Radio.
I got a feeling that tonight's gonna be a good night. That tonight's gonna be a good night. That tonight's gonna be a good, good night. I feel it. That tonight's gonna be a good night. That tonight's gonna be a good night. That tonight's gonna be a good, good night. Tonight's the night. Let's live it up. I got my money. Let's spin it up. Go out and smash it.
Hello, welcome to the second edition of Today's Woman on the World of Ink Network. I am Willow Cross, one of your hosts, and today we have Carol Kuntz, Kelly Abel, and Susan Burdorf. Ashley and Stacy may or may not be in before the show's over. They both have things going on. Hello, ladies.
Hello.
Hey, hello.
It's good to be back together again.
Yeah.
Today's show, we're going to be discussing dealing with your children's choice of significant others, healthcare professionals, and making sure you're not just a number in beginnings and backup plans, what not to worry about. So let's just start with our first segment. If you have any questions or you'd like to call in and tell a story that relates to the topic, you may call in at 714-242-5259. And Susan, Kelly, I will give you the floor dealing with your children's choice of significant others.
Okay, great. Welcome, everybody. We're glad to have you with us this afternoon. The topic came to me this week because there used to be a show, and I don't even know if it's still on MTV or not, I should have looked up the title before the show, but the title had something to do with parental choice of the boy or girl's boyfriend or girlfriend or significant other, and they would interview all these people and make the choice for their son or daughter, and then they would be able to either pick the person they were currently dating or pick the new person that their parents picked for them. And I got to thinking about that this week, and I thought, well, what is the right thing to do? And I've had, situations where my children have dated people that I didn't necessarily want them to end up with, and it seemed to me the more I got involved, the worse or more determined they were to stay with that person. And so I thought I'd kind of throw it out there to the crowd and just see what you've done in the past and what are some of the decisions you made, how well they worked out for you, how well, they didn't, and what types of things did you do in order to make the situation better or worse. Now, occasionally your child will actually marry someone that, it's not that you don't want them in the family or that type of thing, but that maybe you just don't see eye to eye on certain things, or
girl,
maybe you don't want them in the family.
Girl, sometimes you don't want them in your family, I can promise. I'll be good now,
uh-huh.
Sorry.
Yeah.
That's funny. So what do you do? When you're faced with this dilemma and you want the best for your children and they may not have chosen wisely. So what, in your opinion, now, of course, this is all opinion. I'm no expert. I'm no psychologist. I'm no Dr. Phil. But the way I have dealt with it in the past is really I just kind of, there's never been any situation for me where there's been physical danger or emotional, abuse or anything of that nature. I'm not going down that road. If that's the case, then of course that's a whole different topic. And we can talk about that some if you want. But what I was thinking of is just, they're just not the person that you would have picked for them possibly. And how do we as mothers and women of today deal with these types of situations? And what I have done, and probably largely due to my husband's advice a lot of times, is just let things play out. You know, I have to bite my tongue, and sometimes if I'm asked, I will give my opinion, my honest opinion, but if I'm not asked, I don't volunteer. How about you, ladies? Have you run into this before with children?
I have, and my daughter, who I love dearly, has made some really, I consider, you know, and she knows it, poor choices. And I saw right off the bat, it was like when you can see far, you know, I look objectively and stuff like that. And after each relationship, she'd say, "Why didn't you tell me?" And I said, "Because you're an adult, okay?" There was nothing life-threatening or no, you know, mental or physical abuse, but it was just these people were manipulative. And my daughter is very outgoing. She's very loving. She's very giving. And sometimes I feel she gives too much. And but I kept my mouth shut because if I had interfered, I know how she would have been. It would have been like, "Mother, it's not your, you know, it's not your place to say anything." But yet, after each relationship, it was like, "Why didn't you tell me?" And I told my husband, I said, "You know, you just don't know. You want to say something you so badly, and you want to embrace this person." And I'm like this with everybody. I give everybody a chance because you just don't know. But there's sure. that gut feeling about people. You know, it's and I have a really good gut feeling. I was born that way. I always knew who to gel with and who to stay away from. And so,
right.
In my opinion, it's let them, unless it's physical or emotional, you know, verbal and stuff like that, I just think you should kind of have sit down and have a talk with them and talk to them like they're adults, not like they're, you know, like they don't know what a clue what's going on. But otherwise, just butt out. And be there when it fails, which, you know, you get that little feeling. And that's just my two cents. And like I said, I'm not Dr. Phil either, like Kelly said.
Right.
We're just mothers. And we have to be Dr. Phil sometimes. Because
sometimes we do.
We're so many. Yes, we do. So anyway, who else?
I think as mothers we play several different roles in not only our
yes.
children's lives,
yes.
but, you know, our friends, our spouses, our people we work with, and You do get called upon a lot of the time to play those roles, whether you feel equipped to do it or not.
Right. Well, I've had some experience. I've had some experience with that was, you know, I had to throw that little laugh in there, with situations that were not ideal. And I want you to know that when I say it that way, that is the kindest way possible that I can say it, and nowhere close to the actual truth. And I'll tell you what, in the beginning I did not handle it correctly. I don't feel like I did because depending on the age group of your grown child or even teenagers and their level of maturity, sometimes you can actually make it worse. For sure, by pushing and saying, "Oh no, oh not no, just hell no, no, we're not doing this."
Right.
Kia,
that's a good point about the age of the person, whether
yeah.
they're a teenager
uh-huh.
or whether they're young adult or even moving into their 30s, you know, or 40s, or even older than that, you know.
Right.
So you're right.
It makes a huge difference because I can tell you that now. Constructive, I don't know that I would call it constructive criticism anymore. What might have been a criticism or at least me trying to get them to see what I was seeing. Because, yeah, girls, you know, we've been around the block a couple times. There's certain ones you see that coming. You can
oh, yeah.
5 minutes and you're like, okay, this is not going to end well for anyone. And I'm very rarely wrong, very rarely. So
me too.
When they were younger, I was very much you know, I would push and push. No, you're not. He's going to do this and he's going to do that and you're going to be miserable. And then they'd get mad. And I actually did have a daughter get married simply because I told her that he was awful. And then she's divorced now because he's awful. And getting to say I told you so was not nearly as happy-making as one would think, because it was just a depressing situation for her and everything. So now I've learned, though, I'm sorry I'm rambling a bit. I'm really tired today. I've learned since then to just back off. And when they say, because they'll ask me, they always say, well, what do you think of so-and-so? And if I'm getting a vibe that's not so cool, I'll be like, well, you know, they're okay. I'll wait. I'm not going to pass judgment. I'll wait. See, let's see what they do. Because my big concern is always how my child, regardless of their age, is being treated, you know?
Sure,
if it may be somebody that I think is ugly as a mud fence, but as long as my daughter is happy or my son is happy, that's all that matters. And just for the record, in case anybody in the family is listening, nobody's with somebody ugly as a mud fence, so I don't want to hear that tomorrow. I just thought they're going to all come to me and say, do you think she's ugly?
I know. You're in trouble, Willow. You're in big trouble.
Just an example.
Exactly.
Yeah, and I've faced that situation, too, where I've looked at it and said, well, you know what? It could always be worse. And and it definitely can. I mean, and then, like I say, you know, barring they're in a physically dangerous situation, which
right.
I would act immediately, you know, if that were me. But did any of you, this is a question I have, did any of you face that from your parents when you made your choice?
Oh,
were
no, I wish. I wish somebody would have said, okay, listen, the first time I got married, I married my first husband 4 days after he graduated from high school. Somebody should have knocked me in the head. Somebody should have tied me up and said, you are not going to the church or anywhere else today. Unfortunately, they loved me just enough to let me do whatever it is I wanted to do. So, no, I didn't get that at all. My parents were very supportive in, you know, my choices, even though they were horrible.
I was pretty young. I was 19 when I got married. And looking back on it now as a parent, my husband and I were talking about this just yesterday. Looking back on it now, my father never said a word, never made any comment whatsoever. It was always, okay, that's what you decide to do. That's what you decide to do. But looking back on it now, that we're parents and our children are of the same age as we were when we got married, we're thinking, wow, he must have been just churning his gut just because we were so young and so naive and so stupid. But, you know, it worked out. We've been married over 30 years, so, you know, it worked out. But, you know, I have had those feelings, you know, and I'm thinking, oh, gosh, what if it's not the right decision? But then, you know what? It's not my life. It's not my decision to make.
Right.
And you're right. I just need to be there should something happen and pick up the pieces, you know, and help them through that journey, through that part of their life.
Right.
So, you know, I think what I'm hearing from most of us, and I don't think we've all had a chance to weigh in, but it's kind of like that, just if you're asked your opinion and they want your honest opinion, you don't need to hold back, but to butt in is probably not the right thing to do.
Right.
I was 19 also when I got married. I went to a boarding school for 3 years, my last 3 years of high school. So I wasn't home during the week and only came home on weekends, if I did come home on weekends. Sometimes I went and spent weekends with others. So I kind of, you know, in a way drifted from my parents. I wasn't home every single day. They didn't have control over who I was dating or anything like that. And I remember my mother, up until the time I was getting married, she said, don't you think you're a little young? Don't you think you need to think about this? Because she had gotten married at 19. And I look back on it now because I've been married for 39 years next month. And I think to myself, yeah, she was so right. yes, you know, I mean, she was. I was young. Even though I had a different experience than most teenagers, whereas you had to go and be responsible for yourself in these dormitories that you lived in. And, yes, we had women that were our dorm mothers, but they were hopeless. I mean, kids got away with so much stuff. My mother would cringe if she knew what happened at our school. But anyway, but you grew up really quick. So I always thought I was so mature.
I can see that would make you more mature, yeah.
Yeah. So, and I wasn't. I was not mature at all. I mean, I was completely, I went from England where I went to school, and then I came to the States, and my husband had shift work, and he was gone, you know, for 12 hours. He was in the military for 12 hours at a time. And I was stuck in a little apartment surrounded by foreigners because we're at a big base and they had a lot of foreigners come over that didn't speak English. So I had no friends. And, you know, I'm thinking to myself, what have I done? You know, I mean, I really, so, but I think it made me, it did make me
grow up.
I tell you, it really, yeah, it did. But I wanted to interject, too, about husbands. My husband, it drives me nuts. He will meet somebody that our kids have met and stuff like that, and he'll come home, and he'll say, are you kidding me? Are you kidding me? Aren't you going to say something? And I'm thinking, why is it my place to say something? Why is it? You get that feeling, too. Why is it my place to say something about our children's choices? And, but, you know, after I tell him, I said, you man up and you say something to her or him. And he's like, oh, no, no, they listen to you better. You're the mother. And I'm thinking, oh, you are so.
Such a chicken.
It is. He is his chicken. Yep. I call him something else, but I won't say that on the air. No. Anyway. But he is, definitely.
Yeah, mine's the same. Mine uses that same phrase. Over your, they talk to you about things they don't talk to me about. And I'm like, really? Come on.
No, because you don't listen. You know, they only call you with the good stuff. I get all the bad stuff, okay? You know, they know that you don't want to listen to their stuff. So that's why they call me. By the way, that was Susan that just said that, not Carol, in case my kids listen to this. Okay.
Trouble. I appreciate that. I do have,
yeah, there you go, Susan.
Add something. I haven't had a chance to say something. I'd like to add something to it whenever everybody's done with the comments.
No, go ahead. Go ahead.
I have four kids, three daughters and a son. And my oldest daughter was the one who dated the most. Well, no, I take it back. My second daughter was the one who dated the most. But anyway, my oldest daughter, when she was in high school, she was very shy. And so I encouraged her to try to get out and meet people, join some groups and, you know, do that kind of thing. And in our neighborhood, we had a family that were less than desirable, and one of their sons took a shine to my daughter. Now, I am not a prejudiced person. He was black, but it didn't bother me in the least. But he didn't treat her well. And I said, black or white, it doesn't matter. What matters is how well, like you guys have already commented, how well they treat you. So it lasted a week. It was more of a, yes, I had a boyfriend. Now I can talk about I had this boyfriend. And then she was done with it. She didn't want to have anything to do with him because she realized he didn't treat her well. But as she got older, in her 20s, she dated another young man who took advantage of her. But she's a very trusting girl. She thinks that because she's an honest person, they will be honest. Mm-hmm. And I bit my tongue and I stayed out of it. I shouldn't have. I should have intervened. He was not nice. He was using her to get a place to stay because he'd been thrown out of his home. And then he would talk about her behind her back at the clubs they went to and things like that. And so I have always stayed out of my kids' relationship unless they came and asked me questions. And then they probably realized they shouldn't ask me because I would be brutally honest about what I liked and what I didn't like. So, I mean, I tried to stay out, but if I saw them about to be hurt, then I would have to intervene. And that's how I always parented my kids. But one of my daughters moved out when she was 18. Her and her father had a fight, and so she moved out, moved in with a boyfriend, moved about 2 hours away from me. So I didn't see her very much. So I didn't know what was going on with her. And that always bothered me that I wasn't more involved. So my biggest advice to any parent that's out there listening is, in this situation, if you feel that your child is going to be in danger, then you have to speak up. Even if they hate you, you have to speak up and not just sit back and say, well, you know, it's their life, they can do what they want, and yes, they can. But they won't see the things that you can see because you're not emotionally involved in that relationship. And so as a parent, it's our responsibility to intervene in those cases. Otherwise, they've got to make those choices on their own. That's what helps them grow. So that's how I feel about it.
Good point. Very good point. And that was, was that Carol?
Yeah, that was Carol.
Carol. Okay.
No, that was Susan.
Yeah, and I agree with you, Carol. I think anytime there is danger involved or you feel like something is going, you know, severely amok, then yes, I agree. We should definitely step in. And I think that's a mother's instinct anyway. I think, you know, the she lion comes out and we protect our cubs and do whatever we have to do. But until you really know one way or the other, it's, you know, it's tough to make those calls. But, you know, and everybody's different. Every child is different. Every parent is different. So sometimes you just have to kind of wing it and do the best you can with the information that you're given. And that's all we can do. But it was a very good discussion, ladies. Thank you very much. And, yeah, I've learned a lot.
Okay. Thank you, everybody.
Are you still awake, Willow? I was worried about
you. I am still awake. I'm sorry. I'm telling you, I'm running on no gas, girls. Our next heading into, and sorry, there was no segue. It was just me. Healthcare professionals and making sure you are not just another number. Now, this particular topic is very near and dear to both Susan and Carol's hearts. So I will let you girls have the floor and just go ahead with it.
Susan, you can go first. You have a big topic about it.
Yeah, a recent situation.
Yes.
So the topic is basically about taking responsibility for your health and not letting doctors or anyone else dictate what you do in a situation that is involving your personal health. So I have one of my daughters recently found out that she may have a situation with her thyroid. She's been dealing with it for a while, and they put her on different medications, and it seemed to be helping. And basically she went in because she couldn't lose weight. She wanted to know why she still couldn't lose the baby weight. She'd had a baby almost 2 years ago, and she wasn't fat by any means, but she just wanted to lose weight, and nothing she did was helping. So they did some tests and blood work and all that kind of stuff, and they found out that it was her thyroid. So they put her on some medications, and she got it under control, and things were going swimmingly for a while, and then it stalled out again. And so she went back to the doctor to find out what was going on. And they said, well, you know, we're going to run some tests. We're going to do a biopsy and see what's the situation. And the first thing, of course, they said to her was, it might be cancer. And that was it. There was no, we don't worry about it, or, you know, here's the research on it, or any of that kind of stuff. So they kind of left her scared, basically. And I don't think that's a good way to be, you know, a productive medical professional when you have a person who's a young mother and she has responsibilities and things like that, and to just kind of drop that C word like a bomb in the middle of everything. And then she went to the doctor and did the biopsy, and she went back for her results. And of course, it took a week to get the results. She went back. They said, oh, yeah, they're done, but we haven't written up the report yet. And they said, do you want to come back? And she said, no, I'm here. I'm just going to stay. 3 hours later, her doctor apologized to her profusely. It wasn't the doctor's fault. It was the lab. And they hadn't gotten her results done yet. They had everything. They just hadn't written up the reports yet. So she was sitting there for 3 hours wondering, oh, my God, is something horribly wrong with me? What's going on? And nobody could give her any answers. And that's not a good way to run a business. If I did that in my business, I'd get fired, you know. And they held her hostage, basically, emotionally hostage for all this time with this understanding that something was wrong, but they would get back to her on it. Or, don't worry about it, it could be this, it could be that, but most likely it's this, but who knows, you know? And so when they were reading the test, they said to her, there's something else in here that we can't quite tell. They tested four spots. Three of them were fine. There was nothing wrong. The fourth one, they couldn't tell. The photo they had taken was not good. So she has to go back in 6 weeks and have another photo taken of this area.
Wow.
Where they didn't get a good photo this time.
Unbelievable.
Yeah. So meanwhile, you know, who can be happy? Who can get on with their life? Who can do whatever they need to do, knowing that inside of you maybe something's wrong and nobody seems to be that, you know, they're not, it's an urgent matter for anyone except, of course, for the one who's suffering with it, wondering what's going on. So I just wonder, has anybody else experienced those kind of things when they go, and how do they handle it? How do they get to the doctor and say, this is not right? I'm, you know, very upset about this. What else can I do to make you understand that this is my health? I want to get on the path to wellness, and you're delaying this.
Right.
Okay, so this is near and dear to my heart. I grew up in England, and I grew up that you don't talk back to your elders. And it took me 40 years to talk back to my elders. And it took something drastic. And I died on the table in the OR. And, of course, I'm not a ghost, Willow, so don't, you know I'm not a ghost, right? Okay. So, but anyway.
If you are, you're a very articulate one.
But I have worked for doctors throughout my young life. I don't work anymore, but, and luckily I worked for some of the most wonderful doctors in the world that treated patients like a human being, not a number. And it enrages me, the fact that people feel, I think it's intimidation. When you go in and you see that this man has gone to school for 1,000 years and he's got all these degrees and he acts, or the woman, acts like they're gods, you do feel that intimidation. What we don't realize is they're human beings. Doctors practice medicine. They don't know everything. And the fact that when a person comes into their office and they think there's something off with them, something's wrong, the fact that they say it might be cancer drives me nuts until they actually know the whole truth. You should never. So I think we need to educate these learned people that how to come across to patients. And I do that with my doctors, unfortunately. I think they see me coming. I kill them with kindness, but I do tell them, if you think there's something wrong, don't tell me right now. Wait until we get the results back. Then tell me. Don't keep me waiting for 2 or 3 weeks between a biopsy, because you feel like you die a little bit every day because you're thinking all these thoughts. Am I going to be around next year? How much longer do I have to live? You know, we don't have a finite date of when we are going to expire. But when somebody puts that fear into your mind, you start to think about that date and how it's going to come about really soon. I have a friend, and she had some female problems. So she went into the doctor. They did an ultrasound. And the doctor says, oh, my gosh, we have to go in and take that tumor out. It's in your uterus. We're going to have to take it out, blah, blah, blah. I'll try and get as much as I can. Well, her husband is Italian. And I'm not saying anything about Italian people, but you know how people say Italians worry a lot. They seem to worry, you know. It's in their genetic makeup. And he was a typical, oh, my gosh, he worried about everything. You know, I mean, that poor man, I used to sit there and say, calm down, calm down. And she was so calm, so they had the yin and yang thing going. And she went in to have it done. She told the doctor, do not tell him what you find, okay? Any inkling that you think, do not tell him. Wait until I wake up, tell me, and then I will tell him. The less he knows, the better off he is, okay? So they go in, they open her up. The doctor comes out. What does he do? Before she even wakes up, she goes to the husband, she goes to the son, and he sits down with him. She says, oh, my gosh, that was the most horrible tumor I've ever seen in my whole life. It's cancerous. and sent it off for a biopsy, but he said, we're going to have to start her on chemo and radiation immediately because I couldn't get it all. And if we don't try and arrest it, she might only have a few months to live. So she wakes up, her husband's in tears, her son looks, he's as white as a ghost, you know, and she's like, what? And, you know, she was so angry, she couldn't get out of bed, she just had surgery. So when the doctor came by, she let him have it. And he said, well, you know, I'm sorry, I forgot. And she said, no, you're supposed to remember, I am your patient. You know, this is a big thing. This wasn't just saying, oh, remember to put, you know, me down for a low-calorie, you know, meal. It's nothing like that. Not to tell my husband was a big deal. And now you've got him all messed up. Well, he needs to be, because he needs to come to reality that you're not going to be around maybe if you don't get chemo and radiation right away. She goes, no, I'm not going to take it until I get the results back. 2 weeks later, she goes into his office. It's benign. It's not cancerous.
Oh, wow.
So for 2 weeks,
wow.
They went. And if she had not listened to her inner self and thought, what's two more weeks? I can wait 2 more weeks to go do this. For some
right.
reason, she said, I have this feeling that this is not what they're saying it is. And she said, Carol, she says, I almost came unglued at this guy. He looked at me and he said, this has taught me something. And she said, I was shocked. He said, I can't believe I was so wrong. And she said, well, that's because you're human. You make mistakes. But she said, this was the wrong kind of mistake. And I hope you learn a lot from this mistake. Because for 2 weeks, we lived in hell. And she
right.
walked out. And I thought to myself, she handled better than I would have. I mean, I would have gone to the eyewitness news and blasted his name. And, you know, I, at that point, because I would have been so enraged. But I think what it is, ladies, don't feel intimidated. Even men, if you're listening, don't feel intimidated. Yes, they have had years of schooling, but they don't know everything. If you feel comfortable with your doctor, that's a good thing. I just let go of one of my doctors and got a new one. Because the other doctor, it was just like, I go in, and she's like a robot. You know, I mean, it was so alien to me because I've always had ones that are very, you know, into, well, how's your kids, you know? Well, how's their kids, you know? Interaction. But my father went to one that he looked at the computer all the time. And my mother went in one time with him, and he didn't look at my dad once, not once. And he said, well, what do you think's wrong with you? And my mother said, excuse me? That's why we're here, to see what's wrong with him. You're supposed to be the doctor. And then he looked up and looked at my mom, gave her a deadly look, and just went back to his computer. And they walked out. My mother's very vocal. My dad's very, he doesn't like to be vocal. But she walked out, she said, does he do that every time you go in? She goes, yeah. Well, we're finding a new doctor. He said, that's ridiculous. He didn't even once look at my father. So get respect.
Wow.
Okay, you are the patient. You know there's something wrong or you're going in just for a routine physical. You are the patient. Take control, okay? This is your body, okay? They may find things wrong, but, you know, if the person says, well, it might be cancer, say, well, we don't know that yet, do we? Put them on the spot because they have to realize that sometimes they don't think. They're like machines. In medical school, I think they're starting to do it now, but I know the doctors I work for were empathetic naturally, thank goodness. But they said there was no classes in school to teach you empathy, to teach you how to be a human being instead of a robot. And I think that's, as a patient, we need to start training them to be more human and to be more. And I think, you know, they see so many horrible things, and I see that. I get that. I saw a lot of horrible things, but I still was empathetic. I didn't lose that. And I didn't lose my sanity by being empathetic. So what they have to understand is, you know, it doesn't hurt them just to be a little kind to you, to be a little more human to you instead of just dictating what you should do. And for all of you out there, if somebody tells you one thing, get a second opinion and don't go in the same town. Go outside your town. that's something I want to express, because my parents live in this little village, I call it. It's a retirement community called the Villages. And the doctors that have come there, my mother went for a second opinion within the Villages. And the person says, oh, the doctor did such a great job. Oh, my gosh, it's just wonderful. Yeah, we took her to a teaching hospital, and she had an infection. And they put the thing in wrong. So because they're so close to each other in this little environment, they tend to agree with the other doctor. So if you're gonna, if you have a dire or even not so dire a diagnosis, get a second opinion. Listen to your body. Listen to yourself. You know a lot about your body that doctors don't know. Little things that, you know, may seem, you know, a little off, check on them. You know, it's not going to hurt. It'll only help. Now I'm going to get off my soapbox because, you know, I'm sorry. I get on the soapbox and I'm really going. It's something that I'm really passionate. And it, when I talked to Susan about her daughter, my heart hurt. It actually hurt because that poor young woman who's a mother, a young mother, and her mother, Susan, distressed when I talked to her in her voice. I mean, I felt it because I'm a mother too. And to wait that many weeks and then wait 3 hours for somebody to tell you that practically all of them were normal, but one, they need to go and scan again, that is reprehensible. There's no excuse for that. Somebody needs to be talked to about that. So anyway, I'm going to shut up. Everybody put in their 2 cents in. Does anybody
feel
awake?
I'd like to weigh in first.
Okay.
Yeah, I'm here. Who'd like to weigh in first?
I'm just stunned. I mean, I know it happens. I had my best friend just recently passed away of pancreatic cancer.
Yes.
And she went through something similar. And she would call because here she is terminally ill. She knows she's terminally ill, but still has hope and could get a miracle. You know, we were all praying for it. And when she would call her doctor's office and ask questions, they would treat her like she was annoying them.
Mm-hmm.
The nurse,
mm-hmm.
you know, and there, you know, there's no excuse for that. And especially someone who's in a serious illness and they don't understand it and they're trying to figure out what route they should go and should they have treatment, should they not have treatment. You know, that's a time when a doctor needs to be empathetic. And I agree with you. I think we're not vocal enough. I think a lot of times we think, okay, well, he's bound to know what he's talking about. He's a doctor. And that is such a good point that it is not always the case. And she did change doctors, fortunately or unfortunately, maybe or maybe not soon enough. Who knows? Who can tell? But at least she did, you know, and she felt much more comfortable with the physician that she, you know, changed over to. And it's just a shame, particularly with as much cancer and as much serious illness as is out there, you need doctors who are smart and who are intelligent but also are sympathetic.
Because you feel alone. When you have a diagnosis, you feel like you're the only one in the whole wide world. And you feel like their only lifeline is this doctor because he's the one in charge. And I think people need to sit there and go, wait a second. You know, if the doctor doesn't, if he rushes you through your exam, say, wait a second. You know, I've been waiting for an hour. You know, and if I showed up an hour late for my appointment, I wouldn't have been seen. But I waited for you for an hour. The least you could do is listen to me. And I've done that. I've done that with a doctor. And, oh, my gosh, he looked at me like I had lost my mind. And I said, no. I said, I'm your patient. You want me to be your patient, right? And
good
I ended up dumping him. Yeah, I ended up dumping him because he still didn't change. But that's okay, you know? And believe it or not, I'm a really good patient. I don't want to come off thinking I go in there telling them what to do. I give them, I go in there really nice, and I give them until I feel like maybe they're not getting it or I'm not getting what I should be getting from them. And that's what I think people need to understand, yeah.
And it's about respect. You know, it, yes. it
well,
that goes both
right.
ways. You know, I can respect you and your
medical knowledge and your training and everything you've been through, but I know my body, and you need to respect me because of that.
Yes.
You know.
I have had numerous experiences with healthcare professionals that were less than satisfactory, but the worst one I've ever had, and I'm totally going to put this guy on blast, was at Greenbrier Family Health Center in Greenbrier, Arkansas. And this man was not a doctor. He was a, what do they call it, a nurse's something?
PA?
Practitioner.
Nurse practitioner. Yeah.
And my grandson, who's now five, thankfully, he was a newborn, and about 3 weeks old started projectile vomiting. No fever, no fussy, just every time he ate, he would just projectile vomit. And it got worse and worse. And we had, in the course of 10 days, I had him at a hospital 11 times.
Oh, my gosh.
Because it just wouldn't stop. And he was starving to death. And I knew he was starving to death. And the last time I went, we took him in. With my daughter, of course, this man looked at me and says, I said, look, we need to see a specialist. Something's wrong. It's not, they kept telling us it was the flu. It's not the flu. He's running, no fever. All of a sudden, within 48 hours of that particular time, his eyes started filling with mat, and we couldn't keep it cleaned out. I mean, you could just sit there and watch the gunk fill up in his eyes, and I'm like, this baby's ill. I mean, he was about 6 weeks old and had spent 3 weeks sick as a dog. And this man looks at me and says to me, well, I'm the one with the stethoscope around my neck, so I suppose I might know a thing or two. And I looked at him and said, well, I've raised 7 kids and haven't killed any yet, so I think I might know a little more.
Good for you.
Get me hooked up with a specialist for this baby, or my next call will be to an attorney for malpractice. Something's wrong. So they sent us to the Conway Imaging Center, and before we could even get back home from the ultrasound they did on that baby, they had called and said, get him to Children's now. He had to have surgery. I can't remember what they call it now, but basically you have two sphincter muscles, one at the top of your stomach, one at the bottom. When the top one doesn't work, that's acid reflux. When the bottom doesn't work, that's what he had, and everything he took in would not go through, and he was starved. He literally was starving to death. He had to be on IVs for 2 full days before they could even operate on him because he was just completely dehydrated, malnutritioned, and it was the doctor's fault because 11 times I would take him. There was 2 days where he went to a doctor's appointment and the emergency room same day because I was so angry because it was obvious the kid was starving to death. And nobody would help me. They just wouldn't help me. He's got the flu. Send him home. He's got the flu. Send him home. So there are times where it is necessary to push back.
Yeah.
If you really feel like you're not being, attention is not being given in the manner necessary, you need to push back. Because had I not got back in that man's face and told him, you will do this, I know you're wrong, my grandson would not have lived through that.
No.
He would have died. So it is also a subject that I take very seriously, too. And I would like to say that I know I speak for everyone when I say we're not saying all healthcare professionals are unprofessional.
Oh, no. No.
We're not saying that. But there are enough that don't treat you accordingly. And if your insurance won't allow you to go to a different doctor, then give that doctor an attitude adjustment.
Yeah.
You can do it nicely. Yes, you don't have to threaten.
No, you don't.
you can do it nicely. But let it be known that you're not going to just stand there and be dismissed like you're nothing. Without you and everyone like you, they're broke. And I promise you they don't want to be broke.
No. And they don't want a bad reputation, because I tell you, I have a big mouth. And I tell people, if they say, who screwed up your mom's leg, I'll say, oh, and I give a name. And, yeah, I think he's probably lost a lot of business because I have spoken up. I'm sorry. If he wants to sue me for slander, there's no way he can because it's proven that he screwed up. And he wasn't man enough to talk about it. So.
Right. All right. Well, anybody else have any thoughts on this?
This is Sue. I'd like to add a little bit more to this as well. I work in hospice, and, of course, we get patients who are at end of life. And you would think a doctor who deals with a patient at end of life would be much more compassionate, much more understanding. But we have doctors who will totally ignore that patient when they call, because they are dying anyway. And they will say that, not to us, to the patient, obviously, but, you know, I've heard that said before. And so it stuns me that somebody who goes to school and spends all that time and that effort and loses all that sleep to get that, you know, that degree so that they can do this wonderful thing and be a doctor and help people, which is something they've probably dreamed of since they were a little kid, you know, whatever. And yet when push comes to shove and that moment comes where their character is shown and they refuse to step up, that's when my heart breaks, you know, not just for my daughter who had to wait the 3 hours for a professional to realize, oh, this is my job, this is what I'm supposed to be doing. And they finally went and did it. By gosh, if I'd been there, I would have been in their office just breathing down their neck until they got it done. But fortunately, she didn't allow me to come with her because she's a grown-up. She can handle her own fights, and she did a great job. But it's, you know, it's unfortunate that it has to be that way. And I know a lot of women, there was a friend of mine who recently posted something online about having some issues with her health and the steps that she had to go through and how she had to change 3 doctors because nobody would listen to her. And she'd been struggling for a year with shortness of breath and, you know, a few other things. And finally, because she pushed, they diagnosed her situation. They got her the right medication, and now she's much, much better. She's on the road to recovery. But had she been, and I have to admit, I'm kind of a wimp when it comes to this stuff. I will fight for my children, but it's rare that I'll do anything for myself. I don't know that I would have fought for it. I would have just said, okay, well, it's a diet thing, or I need to exercise more, and I probably would have had a heart attack while I was walking around the track, you know, trying to lose weight that way. But we can't, as a Girl Scout leader, I tell my Girl Scouts who are 14 and 15 years old that they have my permission to go out and fight for themselves.
Yeah.
And so I'm giving everybody permission to go and fight for yourself. No apologies necessary. If you're wrong, that's life. You're wrong. But if you're not wrong, look what you've done for yourself and how you've helped yourself or helped others, because you may have a doctor who suddenly realizes, oh, yeah, you know, I've been stressing and all this other stuff is going on in my life, and I was taking it out on poor quality of care for my patients. So everybody has permission to fight for themselves, and don't stop fighting if you don't feel like that you're getting the answers that you think you need. Who is that actress that played the nanny, had that funny nasally voice?
Fran Drescher.
Yeah.
Way back 15 years, 20 years even, she was going through a really hard time, and she didn't know what it was. She thought it was, she was going through a divorce. She thought it was her divorce that was dragging her health down. Well, it turned out she had, I think, cervical cancer, which is like very, it's a mute cancer. Like they don't find it until like it's almost deadly when they find it. And she fought and fought and fought and figured out that she had something wrong, and she's still with us. So don't stop fighting if you think you've got something going on that's not right, the medication's not helping, or the idea of a diet isn't what's really going on with you. Just don't stop fighting because you have value. There's a reason for you to be here.
You do. And it breaks my heart that the hospice doctors don't have compassion. because I knew an oncologist. And, you know, when you're an oncologist, the majority of your patients do pass away usually. And this one did. He had
right.
a practice that were difficult cancers. He was the most nicest, warmest person I've ever met in my life. And he helped them transition. He gave them their home phone number, his home phone. I could not believe this man. He was truly an angel on this earth. And for somebody to say, it's because my patients die all the time, what do you expect? Yeah.
Yeah.
That doesn't wash with me. I'm sorry. You're in a profession to help people. You're in there to be compassionate. You're to do no harm. You're doing harm if you treat your patients wrong, if you treat them like they're not human beings, that they're like a robot.
Right.
And so I think we need to educate our doctors in the nicest way possible, show them that we are so nice. And my mother used to say, kill people with kindness, Carol. They don't know how to handle it if they're mean. And she said, usually it'll break through. And I tell you, my mother is right. Very few people have I not broken through by killing them with kindness. Yes, I've gotten mad a couple of times, but I needed to. And those people were beyond hope. But, you know, that's neither here nor there. But anyway, I just want people to be empowered. I think the younger generation is more empowered. It's the older generation and the middle generation that I'm talking to, because we're still in that phase where, oh my gosh, they are gods because they went to school and they're so learned and they're such big brains. But guess what? I might not have the biggest brain and be the smartest knife in the drawer, but I have common sense. And sometimes to me, common sense is a lot better than, you know, being so brainy. And so so there has to be a combination of two. And I can say it because I've worked with doctors. I worked around them. And the guys I did work with, I was very fortunate. Like I said, they were wonderful human beings. I watched them cry when they lost a patient. I mean, they were just wonderful. And I wish I could just promote that and... Maybe I should go into hospitals and teach doctors how to be compassionate. Maybe that's my goal in life.
Sounds like
a
calling.
I think they take sensitivity training, but I think a lot of them think it's just one more course, and they don't realize
yes.
the humanity. There's always going to be that one patient that's going to touch you. There's always going to be
yes.
that one that you think, wow, I could have done better, or I did the right things, I need to remember
yes.
this, you know, that kind of thing. But the doctors have to be receptive to it, just like any of us. And,
yes.
And they're,
yes.
a lot of them aren't, because they're worried about the bills they have to pay back for their school. Or, you know, I've got 18 patients to see in the next 2 days, and I, you know, everybody in the office is sick, or I'm not feeling my best, or, you know, and there's always an excuse not to do it.
Yes.
So what I want to see, I want to challenge doctors, is find that reason that you have to do it, that you need to
yeah.
do it, that you're
yeah.
out there and you understand that that person has a family that's going to miss them when they're gone.
Yeah.
Just like you do.
And we're counting on you.
That's always my goal.
It's like the mechanic
yeah.
that fixes your car. You know, I think mechanics sometimes are better than doctors because they want to fix that car, so they get a good reputation. They fix my car. It's wonderful. They don't want you to get out on the road and your brakes fail, and then you be on the nightly news because you're in an accident, and you say, well, I went to so-and-so. Oh, my gosh. I mean, most mechanics I've met take pride in what they do. So let's have these doctors take pride in what they do, you know, that their patients love them. I would think that, you know, well, like I said, there's some out there you're never going to change, but you can change. And you make your insurance. If your insurance companies won't let you change, keep fighting it, because it's your body. And nobody should dictate what you should have done to your body. So, yeah, that's me. I'm off now. I'm sorry.
No, that's okay. That's okay. If everybody's weighed in, though, because we are rounding up on the hour, let's move into our next segment, if we can, beginnings and backup plans, what not to worry about. Whose segment was that? Because I don't remember.
That's mine. It's Sue.
Okay. All right. Well, the floor is yours, my lady.
Okay. Well, kind of like going along with what we've been talking about is taking charge of things in your life. And to me, a beginning isn't just waking up first thing in the morning. It's planning what I'm going to do the next day before I wake up in the morning. So that's part of our beginnings. But also beginnings seem like endings sometimes. And I challenge people to look beyond the end of something to what is going to happen after. Case in point would be I know divorce is talked about quite a bit, but my divorce was very difficult for me personally. I had young kids. They were over 18, but they were still with me in the sense that some of them lived at home with me, some didn't. And I kind of felt like I failed. Like the divorce meant that, I was setting a bad example for my kids. And then my youngest daughter said, "Mom, you know, this is a great opportunity for you to do all those things you always wanted to do. You don't have to worry about raising us anymore. This is a new chapter for you." And I said, "Oh, chapter, write books. Yay, okay. I like to do that. I'll do that." And so it allowed me the freedom from the responsibility of everyone else and only being responsible for me. And granted, a young mother who has younger children, they may have to compartmentalize things a little differently. But for me, it meant entering into a new phase. It was a new beginning for me. It was great. I loved, I was scared. But I loved that my family supported me in it. My thought process it helped me get over a lot of things to think that it's not the end. It's just a new way to start something. So beginnings are important for all of us, but it all comes back to last month, I talked about our attitude, and that's a lot of all of that. And the backup plan part of that is really just making sure that if you have something that doesn't work out, that you have something else that you can do. So don't pin all your hopes on one thing. I'm going to be this famous writer. I'm going to make millions of dollars and support my family just as if my husband were still with me, you know, that kind of thing. That may not happen. I you might get lucky. I'm not saying you won't, but you have to plan beyond that. You have to be prepared for a lot of different things. The best worst case scenario, they had that show for a while and they have those games and all that kind of stuff where you can kind of plan out things. Obviously, I'm not going to go jump off a mountain, although I did jump out of a plane. That was kind of fun. And things like that. So always have some kind of a plan in case your other plan doesn't work out. That's kind of where I was going with that.
Very good. Excellent.
Very good.
Never hurt to have a plan.
No,
A, B,
I think,
or C.
And D, because sometimes you never know. I don't know. See, for the not worrying part, I'm a worrier. That's what I do. That's my thing. So how to not worry... That's, I had somebody just told me yesterday, you need to learn to be more calm and not to worry. And I'm like, what is that?
Huh?
That's an alien concept for me.
Well, I was the biggest worrier in the world. Absolutely the biggest. I think I was probably worse than you, Willow. I know I am, because I used to worry about everything. I mean, everything that could possibly go wrong, what might go wrong, might never, ever go wrong, but it should maybe go wrong. And, I mean, constantly. And until I turned 40. And that's when I died. And I realized that, number one, I'm not scared of dying anymore. I don't worry about, oh, yes, I worry about my kids. I mean, but I don't obsessively worry. If they take a trip, my mother worries like heck for me anyway. So, and I tell her, Mom, she says, why aren't you a nervous wreck? And I said, Mom, because look at you. I don't want to live like that. Yes, she's 79 years old, but she's lived on her nerves all her life. I don't want to be that person. I've decided that, you know, this year I'm going to get rid of the clutter. I'm cluttering and decluttering my house from top to bottom. I am releasing my weight, not losing it, because if you lose something, you try and find it again.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not releasing my husband, though. I'll keep him. It's been 39 years, so I think I'll keep him. But I want to get more organized, too, because I've been disorganized for the last, you know, since 40, because I stopped worrying. And so before that, I was so organized. I mean, I was, everything was organized. Everything was had its place, everything. And I want to go back to that being organized, but I don't want to go back to the worrying. And I think, you know, whatever's going to happen is going to happen. You have no control, but you have control over yourself. And I never thought I could be a meditating person, because when I used to try and meditate, I'd go to groups and try and meditate. I'd be thinking about what we're having for dinner, what was I going to wear tomorrow when I went to this function. I had a doctor's appointment coming up, make sure I make the list before I went. And so my brain never shut down. And I don't know if it's because I'm older now that I can shut my brain down and meditate, but it's the best feeling in the world just to have that peace and just go by yourself and just close your eyes and just empty your mind. And I know that's hard to do, but there's books on it and there's tapes on it. And so, Willow, I want you to stop worrying, because worry is not going to do you any good. Healthy worrying is okay, but not obsessive worrying, no.
My dad used to tell me, because I was that way when I was a child, I would worry about everything. And if I didn't have something to worry about actively, I would invent something. And I would. And he would tell
me. That was
me,
yeah.
Mm-hmm. He would say, Kelly, 90% of the stuff you worry about never happens.
Yeah, true.
And he was right. He was right. And then the other thing he used to always say is, well, still says, I'm lucky to still have him, but... You know, he says, don't borrow trouble. Don't go, you know, and my husband will do this from time to time. He'll be like, well, what is this and what is that? Don't borrow trouble. Don't worry about that. If it happens, we'll cross that bridge. But don't borrow trouble by worrying about it. Because I think sometimes you can create things with your own
mm-hmm.
energy just
yes,
by worrying about
can.
It.
Yeah.
And so just let it go. You know, don't
yeah.
worry about it. Don't. Borrow trouble, and 90% of the stuff you worry about never happens anyway. So let it go. And I'm better
so
about
Willow,
it.
I think,
worry, of course I do.
Kelly,
but,
do you think that Willow should be our project?
Yes.
Yes,
we should
I
make Willow our project.
Yes, we'll make Willow our project. Okay, Susan, you're in it too, because you found your Zen too. So we need to help
yes,
Willow
I did.
Find
Thank
her.
Thank you. We'll help her find it. That is true.
Yeah.
Okay.
It's not that hard to find. You just have to know when you've found it.
Yeah.
Well, I guess I don't mind being the project. I'll take one for the
and
team.
Right now you're too tired.
Yes, you're tired.
We won't push it now because you're exhausted.
Oh, I'm so tired. I'm so tired of sitting here, my eyes are crossing.
I know.
Just try to find some time to get some rest.
Yes.
Yes.
You can't help anybody else if you're worn out. So.
No, that's true, and that's absolutely true. That's why I'm getting healthy, because I can't help people if I'm not healthy.
That's
so,
true.
Yep. I want to go to conventions and not feel like the old lady, which I am. Usually I'm the oldest one there. And then by the end of the weekend or the 4 days, I am exhausted, beyond exhausted. It comes home and I'm, you know, my husband says, I don't think that's good for you to do that because you're just, it wears you out. So this year I'm going to do better, yes.
Well, on that note, my friends,
yes.
It is 3:04.
Okay.
Is there any other topics anybody wants to discuss, or anybody have any feedback on some of the topics that we've already discussed today? I'll take that as a no.
I think we did a really good job.
We did. I think that been thoroughly discussed. Well, let's do this, ladies. Go around and introduce yourselves and make sure you give your website and contact info for the listeners, and we'll just start wrapping up.
Okay. Should I go? Okay. I'm Carol Coons. You can find me on Facebook. I'm also under Amanda Jason. That's my pen name. You can like my page. It's Amanda and Jason. And then I'm also Carol Conert Coons, but just look at Carol Coons. You can find me on Facebook, and I'll follow you. I love to talk. I love to be positive. And I'm also on Twitter as Amanda Jason. And I would love to interact with anybody that's listening. So, and that's me.
I'm Kelly Abel. I am an author and graphic designer. And I can be found on Facebook also. It's K-E-L-L-Y-A-B-E-L-L. Sometimes people want to spell it A-B-L-E, but it is A-B-E-L-L. And I have a website, which is kellyablebooks.com. And I, like Carol, love to interact with readers, love to discuss books, movies, whatever you like to talk about. I do enjoy interacting with my readers and anyone for that matter. So reach out. I'd love to hear from you.
Okay.
All right.
Susan?
And I'm Susan Burdorf, and you can catch me on Facebook. My website is still under construction. But I have not published any actual novels yet, although I'm working on several right now that will be out this year. But I currently am in many anthologies. If you look me up on Amazon, you'll see how many, many, many I'm in. And I love to do shorter stories, so novels, that's why they're taking a little longer. It's like 4 short stories for me. And I'm in one right now. I love to do anthologies that benefit some kind of charity. I'm in one right now that is benefiting diabetes that will be releasing in May that I'm very excited about. It's a dragon anthology, and it's going to be awesome. The stories in it are great. We've got a wonderful editor beating us with a cane stick to make sure we get our stories up to snuff. So I know everyone will love them, and there's several others that will be coming out this year in a little bit that I'll be mentioning in the months going forward. So thanks for listening, everyone. We can't do this without all of you, and feel free anytime to send us some feedback. That's it for
Very
me.
Very good.
Yes, thank you. Thank you so much.
All right. And I'm Will Cross, and if you can't find me online, you are just not looking hard enough. Because I'm everywhere. Follow me on Twitter, like me on Facebook. Listen, check out the Paranormal Hour. That's another show I'm on with World of Being. Kelly's on it too, as a matter of fact. We've got some pretty cool guests coming up here in the next few weeks. And if you like the spooky stuff, boy, do we have it in spades for you. Also, you can check out my haunted series on Amazon. This is true ghost stories because I see dead people, and you might find that interesting. From everyone here at the World of Ink Network, we sure thank you for joining us and hope that you'll come back the next time. See you later. Bye.
I got a feeling that tonight's gonna be a good night. That tonight's gonna be a good night. That tonight's gonna be a good, good night. I feel it. That tonight's gonna be a good night. That tonight's gonna be a good night. That tonight's gonna be Let's kick it off.